Bomanjika, and welcome to the Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Tony Armstrong, and this podcast is all about celebrating Indigenous art and design in all of its shapes and forms. This podcast also marks the opening of Wadamurra, NGV's new exhibition. Wadamurra means many mobs in the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung language, and as the title says, the exhibition showcases the diversity of First Nations art and design with incredible works from emerging and senior artists from all around the country. Like me, you may be wondering, what exactly is Indigenous art? Is it more than traditional dot paintings? And how much has it developed over the years into the contemporary practices of today? Let's find out. In this episode, I'm joined by two incredible artists, both who have work in the exhibition, Tony Albert and Keamon Williams. Both Tony and Keamon's work looks to reframe First Nations histories in different ways by appropriating found materials, language, and symbols of Indigenous culture. Keamon is the youngest artist in the show, while Tony is a senior figure in the art world who is known for using what he calls Aboriginalia. Tony, Keamon, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Tone, I'll start with you. Can you introduce yourself, who's your mob, where you're from, and maybe talk a little bit about your practice?
Well, I'm a far north Queensland boy, around Townsville, Cairns, Gidame, Yidinji, Kukuyalanji, all those mob connections, but lived and worked across Brisbane and Sydney at the moment, which is quite wonderful as an artist to have that kind of span. Brisbane is where pretty much I call home, but Sydney is really not only my adopted home, but I think in the art world, the platform for the rest of the world and that connection and that, you know, incredible opportunity which a place like Sydney really offered me, you know, about a decade ago, and I just can't leave yet.
Yeah. Well, it is a beautiful place,
it is.
Particularly if you've got a reason to be there. Why would you go anywhere else? Keamon, exactly the same question to you. Introduce yourself. Who's your mob? Where are you from?
Yeah.
Talk about your practice a little bit.
Yeah, my name's Keamon. I'm a Koa, Kugyalanji and Miriam Murr. And born in Brisbane but grew up in Cairns, far north Queensland. So I like it hot, and I mean, even now I'm not like wearing really warm stuff. I just love that kind of like defying the temperature sort of aesthetic. And yeah, coming up at the moment in an interesting place, I think, exploring practice in a way that kind of heals and affirms mob through personal experience. And I think it's been really interesting. Brisbane, there's almost like a familial connection with people. Like everyone's just really welcoming. And I think it's just at the moment I feel really privileged to live and work on Mianjin. For me, I'm just excited to be here.
Yeah, the shorts is an absolutely incredibly bold move. I mean, it's about a degree and a half outside. I think it might be raining at the moment, but that's boss. If you've got Ferraris, don't leave them in the garage. I mean, get them out there.
I don't think I could pull them off on a hot day.
Jeez, Tony's in the tracksuit pants again. So I'm very interested about... So I grew up with this preconception of what blackfella art was. I had this idea until probably I was, you know, 13, 14, whatever it was, that blackfella art was, it was to be lazy. It was dot painting. It was Central Desert stuff. And then, you know, I guess coming into this space and practicing and working in it, how important, Tony, do you find it to challenge not just your audience, but institutions to realize that it's more than that.
It's incredibly important to the point I kind of find it quite profound. You know, even as a North Queenslander, knowing our symbols and designs, how different they are. My idea of Aboriginal art was exactly the same. It was a dot painting from the desert. And we've had to not only escape that way of thinking, we've had to rigorously challenge it. For me, it wasn't until seeing the work of, you know, at this probably around the same age as you were talking about, of Tracy Moffat and Gordon Bennett, and these incredibly powerful works that resonated a story of who we are, not so much what we were supposed to do or supposed to be, but it's like, you know, that they took a bit of your heart and put it on a canvas or a photograph, which, you know, to me, not only challenged that idea of what Aboriginal art was, but for me as a person too, what art was, and in more general to that, was a very beautifully painted picture. You know, the whole idea of contemporary or conceptually based art, you know, didn't even register on the radar, and particularly with Mob, like, you know, we're lucky to have anything on the wall, let alone in, you know, this inheritance of what art was, even in a beautiful traditional style of what it was. But it was certainly artists like that which first made me really switch on to the power of art, how a visual can make us think, how it can make us feel, and how it can resonate really inside of us. And that was one of the most pivotal moments, I think, in my life, was seeing and understand, and, you know, to quote Tracy Moffat, something more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, like, it seems like the more I'm learning about art, it can be this really great mirror of who you are. And then when you see a place that doesn't represent you, that can then be like a double down on, I guess, internalized, whatever it may be. Using humor is something that both of you do. Now, I'm loving your earrings.
Thank you.
They are earrings that say plastic on them in the shape of a pink boomerang. But I mean, how important and how powerful do you see humor as a tool to convey message almost subversively, like bring people in before they realize what mm-hmm. you're saying?
I guess from the expectation of an audience, I think they expect either beauty or sadness or something to really move them and compel them. But I think humor is just the universal language. And I think for me, it's like, I can't always make art, what you say, like black fella art and then white art. It's like the humor is the ingredient that makes it palatable to all tastes. I think it's something that helps to break down the barrier, because there's a lot of barriers in art. And I think it's something that if you set that precedent of, hey, art can be profound and also funny at the same time, I think it allows everyone to be on board. And it's not to say that art can't be serious. I think a lot of humorous art is very serious, because it's like, it's so ridiculous, you have to laugh. I think for me, it's just been a sort of platform, a little secret ingredient, I guess, to sort of, just elevate the work and allow it to be understood, but also so that for more people than just Mob, it can be something that's owned. Mm. People can take the message on and not see it as something that is defamatory or it's going against you. It's like, no, this is all our story and let's laugh together.
Yeah, like empowering, right?
It is. It is so cultural as well. Like, no one can make a joke or a laugh out of complete poverty like black fellas can. There's always
there's a glint in the eye,
a reason to laugh. But I look at humor, I say it's a guerrilla tactic. It's an opportunity to infiltrate. And when I say guerrilla, it is about almost like infiltrating the enemy, you know, a tough way of talking about, I guess, the serious notions of it. But it's much easier to make people laugh at something than to throw facts or statistics or the truth in their face, you know. And that has been an incredible tool for me, because it might not be till that night in bed or a month later, or the encounter of an experience for a non-Indigenous person to go, that's what they were talking about. It's not necessarily direct, but it has a reverence in our lives outside of art as well as within art that is a strong tool in communicating a message.
And I guess you have both spoken about this notion of, like, I guess blackfella art versus whitefella art, and what is it? Do you think the idea of what blackfella art is changing, not just to blackfellas, but say someone just being introduced to the world of art, just piquing an interest in art? Do you think their stock standard definition of what blackfella art would be changing, or do you think there is still so far to go?
I think it's an interesting question. I think in some ways it has, but I don't necessarily think it's a change. I think it's an expansion. I think especially with digital media, social media, all of these things, it allows suddenly, multi-generational conversations to exist at the same time. And I think that's something that we haven't really had before. And I think It's just really interesting that I think we're in a time now where because the view is so much more centered on the individual now, that if that individual is an artist, in a sense, they become the tastemaker for the culture, and they can come in and they can expand it, or they can show ways that that experience has a kind of like an elevated quality of this deserves to be celebrated. This deserves to be an object of beauty or desire or contention, and I'm going to communicate that through art. And I found like quite recently is like people take you seriously when you say you're an artist, which is kind of strange in a way. Like if you come to the table and you say, I'm doing this for the sake of doing it and celebrating it, and I'm having fun at the same time, people find that not just amusing, but they want to promote that. They want to support it, because otherwise you're just listening to the news and the noise and everything else that can be so horrible at the moment. I think art in all facets is something that people can see and attribute joy, or even just like a communal voice to. They can feel heard and seen.
Mm. Well, the world revolves and it turns and it changes. And the biggest thing we have to get over is the stigma of culture being, or us as people, being stagnant, being anthropological, being studied. You know, if there's a canoe or a speedboat next to each other, we know which one we're going to get in. You know, and that's the mindset. And, you know, we will forever be changing and challenging. And, you know, that's the beauty of it all. But it's just making sure people know and understand that.
Yeah, I realized as well in the framing of my question to you, Kimon, I kind of talked about how it's one thing or the other.
Oh, right.
No. And like, mm-hmm. and like, that is just me still getting myself out of my own head around what we're talking about, which is this idea that, you know, black fellow art is done by black fellas. It doesn't matter, you know, what it looks like or how it is. And so, yeah, I realized that when you said it's just an expansion of this idea, which I think is really beautiful. And speaking of black fellow art, Wadamurra is an exhibition at the NGV that the NGV is putting on from October, early October. And I'm so excited about it. You're both featured in it.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be part of, I guess, its announcement to the world and something that's going to be such a pivotal part of, I guess, Australia and the world's art scene?
So interested to hear Kimon's response. I know for me, you know, 2008, going back nearly, you know, a couple of decades, when the Hedy Perkins at the Art Gallery of New South Wales purchased a work of my first ever commercial solo show. And I was so excited. There was really a sense of validation, and that this kind of what you had pushed and what you had worked towards at that time for me, and that's why I'm so keen to hear Kimon, there was something so insightful. Now it's a bit, I need to look back a lot more at that excitement and at those opportunities. But it is really great to see dedicated Aboriginal art spaces, an opportunity for that dialogue amongst ourselves as people. We're too often pitted against each other, particularly in the idea of traditional and urban within the context of art. I look at all the beautiful mediums and the stories. They actually bring us together. They don't pull us apart. And that's one really important thing we need to take note of. But then the infiltration of our work throughout the entire institution is also really important. What context and conversation does it have within Australian art? And then in the same way with international art. And those conversations I even find at this point in my career much more invigorating and important than some of the conversations we have amongst each other. But that's, you know, I'm very keen to hear, you know, because it's from Kimon, because this is your first institutional purchase.
Yeah. And we'll be the youngest person in there as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. What?
Well, gotcha. I like being the bearer of good news. Congratulations.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
It's very, very, very exciting.
Well, yeah. First of all, I feel very grateful, but I think it's also just really affirming, because I was very conscious about making a promise to myself years ago that from this point, I was not going to make work for anyone else. I think it's, you know, you get exhibitions or you get a commission and you're doing something that someone is telling you to do. And sometimes you lose track of what your voice is, I think. And so I made a decision, whether it is any of those things or a solo work project, that I'm going to do whatever I think is fun and exciting because I'm, in a sense, it's like I don't want to be anyone else. Like I'm making the practice and the work that I want to see reflected, and that's took me a long time to get there. But that's what I want is to follow that thread, that practice that excites me. Because if it's not exciting me, it's not going to be exciting to anyone else. And so, yeah, when I got that offer, I think it was. It was quite emotional, but I think it was more so affirming that for so long, I think, you know, especially when you're emerging and you're independent, it's like I'm still putting 80% of my salary into my work because I can't not do that, you know. Yeah. If I don't make those sacrifices, I'm not in this room having this conversation. And so for just a lot of hard work and investing in self, finally that work, these boomerangs, which were just a sort of fun experiment on the side, have just really propelled that practice and become something that was from a place of self-preservation. I'm really trying to push for that work to represent me, is now in a national collection and it represents the people. Like that's not, it was for me, that's where it came from, but now it's for the people, which for me is like huge in a sense that it's like I get to hand over some of that ownership of that work and let it spread its wings, I guess, to be a bit dramatic. But yeah, I'm just really, really excited, and it feels like it's very practice affirming but life affirming to know there's that security, I guess.
Very inspiring.
Yeah. Oh no, that really is. And I suppose as well, you know, to be in institutions that are traditionally white spaces and then to come in and do what you're both doing. You said it was just affirming, but do you feel like there's also like more to it than just the work itself? There's like meaning from a whole mob point of view about what it is you do, particularly when it goes into these institutional spaces that traditionally haven't necessarily been spaces for black fellas?
I'd like to think so. I always say that white spaces made by white people for white people. Society, you know, it goes back to the earlier conversations as well. It's we are changing. The world is changing. I hope it's in the term of getting better as well. But this insertion of these stories and understanding, you know, has an incredible impact on a lot of things. We're facing a climate crisis as we speak, and yet we've got people that are living, sitting here, that have managed the land for tens and thousands of years and done it wonderfully. It's been destroyed in a, you know, 200-year period. So, you know, these stories open up a lot more symbols and meaning and understanding who we are, where we sit, our sense of space and place, and really are in a non-condescending way, you know, changing the world that we live in. And, you know, that's incredibly important. And to think, you know, art or creatives have kind of led all revolutions and markers for incredible change. And, you know, it's wonderful to be involved in that world within these kind of conversations.
Yeah, I agree, and I've been conflicted in my own practice too, trying to think about what it means to make art and how that in itself is a language. And there's like so much of my mob where it's like, I don't know our language, but I know that the greatest Indigenous language has always been what we do, our practice, our everyday. And I think that to be at a point where it's in an exhibition like this where there's such a diversity of work that expands that language of what it means to be Indigenous and expands that language of what it means to practice as an Indigenous person. I think it's an honour, but I think even reflecting on my practice and my being, you know, I'm Indigenous, but I'm also queer. I think it's a thing where you're always kind of combating, like, where are your boundaries? Where are the hazards of where's going too far? Where's not powering through enough? And I think... yeah, with the work, it's like there's language in the work that's affirming, traumatic, depressing, luxurious, but then also a bit sleazy. And I think that that's something that I'm glad that gets to exist in a space like this, in an institution like this, to kind of push that that stereotype of what it is to be Indigenous, or like incorporate more life affirming things into that work, so that people see stuff like that and they understand that it's not just about, you know, our practice is sacred, but we're more than just a sacred being that's, you know, can't be talked to or can't feel pleasure. Can't, you know, I think it's important.
Still modernity. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's important not to celebrate Indigenous artists, but not to put us in a box where we are these like shamans that, you know, like we're people.
Yeah. And yeah, the point you made about where to push and where you're not going far enough, equally as dangerous, I think, if you don't push, but also equally as dangerous if you get it wrong, you know, you got to get it right. Tone, tell me about Aboriginalia.
It for me, it started as a collection as a child, and Aboriginalia is this incredible aesthetic of kitsch, almost. it's not the right word, but it kind of fits.
Is it
well.
Like the fit?
It's you know, the representation of Indigenous imagery on everyday items, which is a mass of cultural cliched rubbish that I collect and surround myself with. But, you know, I always go back to the fact that that collection started from as a child and as a collection that was built on love. And I loved seeing Aboriginal faces on things. I loved seeing people who represented me and my family on objects, because I just thought that was so cool. This must, you know, what famous Aboriginal person is this? Because they're on a cup.
They're on something. They're
on a plate or a tea towel. And praise the Lord, I had wonderful parents that, endorsed and embraced this curiosity that a child had. And at that same point, I was uncovering works by Tracy Moffat and Gordon Bennett. I was understanding the much more sinister undertones attached to these objects, and the lack of autonomy we had as people within them, or the lack of autonomy these objects had within themselves in having a voice and having an opportunity to engage, but still the way in which an entire generation of Australians grew up understanding who we were as black people because of these objects became ever important to me, and I kind of made it my mission to give these objects a voice through my artistic practice. And that's where the love for Aboriginalia stemmed from, and I won't ever stop loving it. And it's a wonderful catalyst for being able to take something like that and ask these hard questions and return it to society within a way that gives it its own autonomy and this own opportunity to speak. There's still too many reference points in life where Aboriginal people are meant to be seen and not heard. And you know, in the same way, your visibility on TV and within media is actually, you know, making incredible inroads into the way in which we're seen and we are witnessed, but most importantly, we are heard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm blushing. Yeah. If I could. Yeah. I mean, I'd never thought about it like that. But yeah, all of these things in these contexts, and you just look at them and you take them for granted as is, without really thinking about what they might be doing to us as people. That's fascinating to hear you say that. I want to go back to what we said before about not going far enough, mm-hmm. or going too far. When do you know, or do you ever know?
It's something that I think comes back to the lens of, it's like, I have to make it for me. If it's potentially pushing into territory that could be dangerous, it's like, on one hand, it's like, if I wouldn't live that in my daily life, I'm not going to make it visible as an artwork. So yeah. I think it's like the only time it really goes to the point where it's like pushing it is if it's the work and me doing it has to be a catalyst to push the message forward, so that it's not something that's talked about in 10 years. It's now. And I think I've not had the issue of having to do that necessarily.
He's so sweet and innocent. Because it's like, don't just break the glass ceiling. Knock the fucking building over. You can never push too hard.
Okay, I have permission.
You just got permission and we filmed it too. Yeah.
No, but isn't it like this is so incredible because if I look back a decade or so at where you are now, queer diaspora was not a part of this world that we're living in. It wasn't, you know, I went to a school where you couldn't even say you're gay. I wouldn't even say I went to a school. I was part of a society.
Yep.
Where that actually just couldn't happen. And for you to be sitting here now representing not just mob, but, then a kind of diaspora within that in such a profoundly heavy yet intrinsic way of who we are as people, I mean, it's very inspiring.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's that thing, you know, that a lot of us struggle with where it's like, you're Australian enough, are you black enough, are you queer enough, all of these things. And then it's like, well, you really just have to understand that those things are just like markers of the space that you take up as a person, and those markers are put on you by other people. It's like you exist how you exist, and you can pull from all of those things, but you only need to go as far as your interaction with those things to make something that's the unique essence of who you are. And so I think it's like, you know, I grew up, I was aware of my cultural connections, but it was something that it was like, barely tangible at best. It was like acknowledged by family, but we were very agreeable, suburban, almost white, because it's just the way that generation grew up, and there was a lot of pressures and restrictions on them. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, it was like, oh, you're queer, good luck. Maybe explore that in like 15 years. So it's like a...
double denomination.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a positive, right? Too negative.
But that's
you know
it,
what I mean?
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it becomes a positive because then it's like if you feel one side isn't potent enough and you've got, oh, this is not going to make any sense. If you've got like half potency in one and half in another, you can combine them to make a full thing. And I think that's the interconnectivity. It's the, I don't need to be queer enough or I don't need to be black enough. I just need to be me. And those things existing is something that pushes a boundary because
for sure.
Yeah. There's still spaces I don't feel comfortable in. And it's both from a cultural and a sexual perspective. And it's just something that's always going to be there. But in art, that's the only space where I get to make the rules. And people then see the work and then embrace those rules there's a relationship there between the work, the artist, and then the people who look at it. And hopefully over time, I think it just builds a sort of a tenderness or at least an alertness to other people's experience.
What you just said there really resonates with me because I grew up not thinking I was like black enough, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're like always trying to be more, and then you're like, well, hang on, like my experience is enough of a black experience, you know. We're all like, it's just ours, and who's to deny us? Whose right is it to deny us that? Mm-hmm. And then when you talk about putting art out that comes from those intersections, you're doing it, and it's your rules. And then people are coming in and looking at it through your rules, and that's got to feel good.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I mean, even it's like, yeah, are you enough of something? It's like, well, the fact that you feel that way means that there's a bigger problem.
Mm. Or if you're part Aboriginal, what part is it?
Oh dear. I mean, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. I guess just finally, when you sit down, Tony, you were talking about like trying to still find that young invigoration and still get, you know, that real inspiration. When you do sit down and you're looking for it, where does that come from?
Oh my God, what a interesting question. The world that surrounds us, I mean, and that's what I really do try to emulate, is that the work comes from a sense of being and an experience. And I try to stay as informed as possible that I can. You know, my life now, you know, is centered, you know, around kids and stuff too now. So it changes a lot. Or you've got, you've got 5 hours of work, of time to do work, to fit in. So you restructure that kind of stuff. But, it is family, it's mob, it's that connection, it's feeling you have maybe the opportunity to be the conduit or the vessel to tell the story. And it always, I think, is reflective from a sense of self, unless you're amazing enough to be given permission to share a story through your own creative talents. But it's the periphery of who we are. And that's, as I've grown, have understood or had the opportunity to travel and understand that that periphery and minority exists in all societies, and it doesn't take long to be within that periphery to understand one thing we all have in common, and that is that we're black and we are colonized. So, you know, that's been my journey. But, you know, I do look at people like Kimon and have to go back to that ever inspirational moments in life and think about a lot of the opportunities I get that are really incredible, and to honour that. Mm. Yeah, we don't do that enough, I think.
Yeah, don't we all? It's as soon as you do it, all right, next.
Yes, it's like
next.
It's a given or a granted, but to keep writing those wish lists down and you know, to where there's a complacency, which I hate, and I think I'm such a believer in telling our children to reach for the stars, and we have to emulate that through our own existence.
That's beautifully said and beautifully summed up on, Tony. Kimon, thank you so much for having a chat to us about not only your work, your inspiration and your practice, and I can't wait to have a look at the exhibition.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks for your time. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people as the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast takes place. I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening. Thanks for joining me today to learn more about Indigenous art. In the next episode, I will be chatting to artist and choreographer Amrita Heppy. Make sure that you get down to the Ian Potter Centre, NGV Australia, to see the Wadamurra exhibition and the NGV's permanent collection of Australian and Indigenous art and design. The exhibition and the collection are completely free and open all year round. See you there.